Hey there, my name is Oisin Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks, presented to you by Harman. And in this episode, we are going to delve into the fascinating world of music tourism. Have you ever travelled to see your favourite band, or visited a city or a place for a music festival, or even joined like-minded fans on a music vacation? Well, you are not alone. Music tourism is a massive trend, and we have two leading experts here to help us unpack this fascinating subject. Welcome to the podcast, Assistant Professor for the Geography of Media and Culture at the Faculty of Spatial Sciences at the University of Groningen, Dr. Leonika Boldeman.
Thank you for having me.
And welcome to the podcast, COO and partner of Topeka Music Vacations and Music Tourism OG, Anthony Diaz.
Really excited to be here. Thanks so much.
Fabulous. Okay, I'm going to start with a really obvious pun, so please excuse me, but that's just how I roll. So if you wouldn't mind, let's just hear a bit about your journey to where you are today professionally, and who'd like to jump in there first?
So actually, I started my career working in the music industry. I used to be a press officer to the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra for a few years. Yannick Nézet-Séguin was the music director at the time, who's now famously the music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra and the Metropolitan Opera in New York. But after a few years of being interested in how to physically get people to the concert hall, I broadened my horizons and wanted to study how music figuratively and literally moves people. So I went back to school in a way and started a PhD in music tourism, focused on music tourism in Europe. When I finished that PhD, I got hired at the University of Groningen at Spatial Sciences, which is all about geography, urban, regional development. And I've been working there ever since.
Fantastic. And you've published some great books and white papers on the subject, which I'm sure we'll come to in a bit. It's a fascinating journey so far. Thank you, Leonika. And Anthony, how about your good self?
From operas and orchestras to, I'll start with the band Kiss. My parents took me to see Kiss in 1978. I think I was 7 years old. It was my first live concert. And it immediately inspired me to want to learn any instrument I could so I can be in a garage band. And I did. I started playing in bands from the age of 10 all the way through college. In college, got in a band that started to get a little bit of traction. We thought we were going to be rock stars. We had a lot of heart. We had a lot of hustle, but we didn't have the songs. And back then, you had to get signed by a big record company. There was no Spotify or YouTube or anything to get your music out. So I embarked into a career of radio, thinking the complement of business and music would be my path, which I really enjoyed. I was on the advertising side. And a bandmate of mine who was in that band in college had started a company called Six Man, which was a pioneer in taking fans and bands together on vacation at sea on cruise ships. So I joined him in that adventure. Our midlife crisis happened when we were 40. I left a big corporate job that I was leading 22 TV stations in the media business with a company called Gannett in the US, and joined him to start taking fans and bands together on vacation at Six Man. That was in 2011. And I joined him as CMO. Years later, became chief operating officer. The company was acquired by Norwegian Cruise Line throughout that process. And we grew from 10 or so employees to, when I left this past December, we had 100 employees and over 25 festivals at sea going on each year. I ended up being the CEO of that company for the last 8 years. And throughout that time, Andy, who had started Six Man, had moved on to start a company called Topeka, which is essentially a music vacation company taking fans on vacation at the beach in Florida. So he and I went for a walk. We had a pint and had a discussion about, will you join me again to see if we can grow Topeka like we had the chance to do together at Six Man? So in January, I joined him as COO and partner at Topeka, and we're off to the races. We're growing this company, and fans and bands seem to really be enjoying it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Six Man and Topeka are really two of the pioneers in this space. It's a safe bet that many of the most famous music cruises and music holidays would have been organized by one of those two companies. So you really have been doing this for a very significant amount of time. But let's come back to a bit of history. Now, music fans like ourselves, we've always traveled to spend time with like-minded people, enjoying the music we love together. But when did music tourism become a significant movement and moment? And I'm coming to yourself first, Leonika.
When we look at music tourism, the development of it is very much bound up with the development of tourism itself, actually. So usually tourism is located at the start of tourism with like the grand tours to Europe, where the elites would go on their trips to Rome and Paris and discover all these cultural cities. And actually from the around 1950s onwards, we see the development of mass tourism happening. The sun, sea, sand kind of idea of tourism starts to develop. And then around kind of like 20, 25 years ago, you see this mass tourism. Tourism is diversifying and niche kinds of tourism start to exist. And this is where we can see that, that music tourism as we know it today really starts to come into its own as another way to go on vacation, where more people have more time and money to spend going on multiple vacations per year. So it's not only your sun, sea, sand vacation anymore, but it's also a city trip. It's also a sports vacation, winter sports, skiing, or in summer hiking, whatever. And all these various kinds of tourism, niche tourism exist together. And this is also where you see the development of music tourism happening.
Fascinating. That's so interesting. Yeah, that's a real kind of compressed history lesson right there. I was expecting nothing less. Thank you very much. And Anthony, when did you first become aware that there was a thing called music tourism? Was this before you joined Six Man, or was that your initiation into the field?
It really was. So Andy Levine and I were in this band in college, and our band broke up. He started managing a band called Sister Hazel that has done really well with their career here in the States and had a number of hits in the over the years. Sister Hazel took 400 Sister Hazel fans on a cruise ship in 2001. And it was really just an opportunity to give back to the street teams. You had all of these college students who had been calling radio stations saying, play the Sister Hazel song, and taking flyers and putting them all around campus. And they called Andy, the manager of Sister Hazel, and said, listen, we've been working really hard. We feel like we've earned the chance to spend some time with the band. And the band agreed. And they looked into different ways to get together. They looked at beach weekends in, different parts of the country. And Andy happened to be on a flight. He was sitting next to a travel agent telling her his problem. And she said, why don't you take him on a cruise? There's venues, there's bars, there's destinations. I think it might work. So Andy and I were really both introduced to the concept when he took Sister Hazel just on a large group. Then they learned that you could charter the whole ship, make it fully immersive to just the ethos of the artists that we're on. And that started Six Man, which has now been, 23, 24 years in running.
Amazing, amazing. And a bit of disclosure here for the listeners. I did go on a music tourism cruise with my wife. It was a Six Man cruise, and it was the Belle and Sebastian Boaty Weekender. And it really is as fun and immersive as you think it is. You are seeing the Buzzcocks on stage, watching from the hot tub, you go down to the theatre and there's Teenage Fan Club, and you're surrounded by music lovers and everyone is there for the same reason. It's an extraordinary experience. So, Leonika, coming back to yourself, you've published some really fascinating books, and one that really caught my eye was called Contemporary Music Tourism, A Theory of Music Topophilia. Can you explain for our listeners, what is musical topophilia?
Musical topophilia is the affective bond between people, place, or setting and music. And actually, that idea derived from the desire I had to try to explain why contemporary music tourism is popular. And in order to do that, first, you have to look at how music tourism is possible in the first place, because a lot of tourism revolves around the visual. It's actually also how tourism developed. It's sightseeing, gazing upon the extraordinary or remarkable places, as a famous sociologist John Urry defined tourism. So for me, the question was, well, much of music is not visible. It's ephemeral. As one of my professors used to say, music is vibrating air. But of course, as audiophiles, we know he was talking about sound and not music. But anyway, how is music tourism possible? So that was kind of the first underlying question. And then how does that connection between music and place, because in order to be a tourist, you have to travel somewhere, how does that connection become so important or remarkable that you actually want to engage in that physical act of travel? And that's where musical topophilia comes in. It connects to the way that people want to emplace themselves, want to be a part of the world. You cannot imagine living without actually living somewhere, right? And being somewhere. So in the book, I explore music tourism as a practice that engages with this very human need to give yourself a place in the world. And in the book, I look at more kinds of music tourism than concert tourism or cruises. I also look at, for example, ways of travel that could be described as pilgrimages, where you see this very affective bond being very strong, but actually it's very, can also be more serendipitous. It's fascinating to see. But again, in the book, I really look at these connections between music and place and how they become meaningful to people, either through music or the other way around, through experiencing music somewhere somewhere and then having these memories and kind of, yeah, this experience feedback into how you listen to the music, for example.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating. The layer of music appreciation on top of a place just adds so much resonance and history there. It's like an audio history. I was in Manchester at time of recording this week, and I, of course, made a little pilgrimage to the former site of the Hacienda nightclub. I did have a guy called Gerald on the headphones, and I visited Tony Wilson Place, named after the great man himself. So, you know, once you're aware of a place having this musical resonance, it really enriches your experience there as a music lover. So I am adding that book to my to-read list for sure. Thank you. But let's, you know, talk about money and talk about impact of like big stars. You know, as everyone listening knows, it's Tay-Tay's world and we just live in it. So an artist like Taylor Swift, someone like Coldplay, Beyonce, they have a big impact on folks going to places. There were some stats from Amadeus released this year, I think, that saw, you know, flights to Romania saw a surge of 91% to see significant artists. Athens experienced a 62% increase in interest of folks traveling to see their favorite bands. What is the impact on music tourism and this idea of traveling to see your favorite bands of these global stars like Taylor Swift?
Doctor, if you could speak maybe on a macro level, I could speak on more the micro. What we're seeing, the Topeka Music Vacations are housed in a quaint little beach town called Miramar Beach, Florida. It's busy during the summer and spring breaks, but it's quiet in April and May and October, November, where we do our music vacations. And we're bringing 20 to 30,000 guests into the market. Now, that pales in comparison to a Taylor Swift, right? Because she's doing 70,000 in one night. But we have seen a massive impact on the community and how well the community is receiving these new visitors that are coming in, because they are going to restaurants and retail and Ubers and hotels and shops, and they're enjoying the area. They're discovering the area, and then they're coming back on their own. So we've really been proud of the tourism we've brought to the Miramar Beach area, and it's helped the community embrace us because we then hire local staff to work our events. We work together with local sponsors to bring brands activated into our events. And it's been really, really healthy for a community that might only have been known just for that sun and fun part of a vacation. You know, on the Taylor Swift, I can give a personal anecdote. My wife and daughter, they could have seen Taylor Swift anywhere here in the States, but they decided to fly to Wembley. They made a girl's trip out of it. She graduated college. It was her big, very nice treat vacation for graduating college. They had the time of their lives. There's no doubt that memories were formed that never would have happened had they gone and see Taylor in Atlanta, because they got to immerse themselves in London, go to the iconic Wembley Stadium, see Taylor Swift in that environment. And I have to imagine that's going on with lots and lots of people of an artist of a Taylor. So big and small, there's just something very special when you travel to a place that's new and exciting and you're with the people who share the same passions. And I think that, Doctor, what you were saying when you used the word topophilia, you know, we use the word community quite a bit. And what we learned over the years is that at first we thought we were in the concert business. Then we thought we were in the vacation business, the hospitality business. And it is a blend of all of that. But really, it's the community building and strengthening business. And you take a fan base and you give them an opportunity to be together. And what's incredible is in year one, they may come for the artist. But year two through 10, because these are annual events, they come for each other. And they love being together. They meet up in their other homes during the year. The friendships and community that's formed in experiences like this is very compelling, and it's life-changing for people.
I love that. Brilliant. Thank you. And Leonika, how about yourself? You know, maybe give us the helicopter view, or maybe a helicopter is too small. Give us the, you know, the jumbo jet view of the impact of music tourism.
First, I would like to respond to Anthony, because actually what you said last is exactly what I saw in my research. I've done a project on music workshops where people play music together and learn how to become better at playing their instruments. And exactly this idea of a family and moving around between festivals and returning not just for the music, but also the community was a very strong theme in what surfaced in that research. So thank you for speaking to that. I think it's very recognizable. So the impact of music tourism. So indeed, with Taylor Swift, there was a lot of news about Swiftonomics and Swiftflation, actually, and the impact that her concert tour would have on economies globally. And actually, you see this a lot as well with mega events, also like the Olympics, like big concerts. Also, it's now been spoken about with Adele in Munich. So to some extent, yes, this happens. Of course, the industry profits around a concert like that, and people people actually travel to other places in the world to see these concerts. On the other hand, you also have some critical voices by economists who say, well, this is all temporary. It's a temporary effect, and it's not unique to Taylor Swift. Other tours have this effect, other events like the Olympics, but it's always the question, what remains of that one-off event for a local economy? And that's, again, also why it's so nice, Anthony, that you spoke about involving the local community in what you organize and what you do, because I think the most successful examples of music tourism actually play into the local economy and the local communities and really try to make that connection.
Yeah, yeah. And as you were both talking there, I was thinking of a few amazing music events I've had the privilege of going to over the years. I'd like to give a shout to the lovely people at Tremor in the Azores. That is an absolutely exceptional festival. It's really, you know, cutting edge curation, but it's all about the local community. The folks who work on the festival are from the local community. The venues are the stunning nature of the Azores themselves, and it really is exceptional. And also, I loved your point about the fact, Anthony, you were saying that the music tourism invigorates this particular place in a time of the year that it wouldn't normally get a lot of attention. This reminds me of Iceland Airwaves, which was built with the Icelandic airline, the national airline, many, many moons ago. And it was basically to entice people to come to Iceland at a time of year when it was dark and cold and people weren't necessarily thinking of coming over there. And it became so successful, it actually tipped the exchange rate of the Icelandic krona at one stage. It adds so much to the economy. It is, you know, a real net positive in every possible aspect for Iceland and the wonderful folks over there in Reykjavik. But let's come back to one of the fundamental questions. Now, we've been talking about music tourism and we've been talking about folks traveling to see a band. Are these different things? Does music tourism encompass this, or does it mean something more? What do we talk about when we talk about music tourism?
I think there are a few things to unpack here. So first, the definition of tourism. What is tourism? What is being a tourist? Is it a way of seeing? And if you call yourself a tourist, that is already tourism. And the same goes for music tourism. Or is it, for example, the UN tourism, which was formerly the World Tourism Organization definition of you have to stay at least one night. So it's one overnight stay that makes someone a tourist. So there are these definition questions. But also, at least what I've seen in my research is that music tourism can be extremely varied. So it's people traveling to hear music played, but it can be other connections to music as well. So you have people traveling because of a song, for example, right? You can go to Liverpool for Penny Lane, and actually Penny Lane exists. But also, for example, music videos or album covers can be very influential. So there's the Joshua Tree album cover by U2, which also has triggered people to go in search of the Joshua Tree that's on the album cover. Another famous example is actually Into the Wild, which is a movie, but also, of course, a successful soundtrack, and people actually wanting to find the magical mystery bus that's central to the narrative in Denali National Park in Alaska. Not always to the happiness of the local people, because it's actually quite a dangerous hike there and people get in trouble. And there are also these issues of tourism involved. It's also people traveling to the birthplace or the house where an artist lived, or the place where a band is from. And it's people traveling to recording studios. So it's the Hansa Studios in Berlin. It's Abbey Road in London. It's all these different kinds of places and connections between music and place. That's why I'm talking about it in this way, that entice people to travel.
Oh, yeah. Actually, you just reminded me, I do need to book a tour of Hansa Studios in Berlin. I believe they do them these days. And you get to listen to some of that iconic Berlin trilogy Bowie in the control room. So that sounds good. Thank you for that reminder. Fascinating stuff. So music tourism is actually a huge topic. It encompasses a lot of different factors. But Anthony, coming back to yourself, talk to us about some of the elements that the folks who go on the Topeka music vacations would value and would expect, and what really makes them feel at home when they come and visit and get together in this community?
Great question. And in part, in welcoming the guest on vacation, we recognize that the expectations of a vacationer are considerably higher from a consumer than just going to a concert. And that's something that we take very seriously. It's their limited vacation time. It is their hard-earned dollars. And they really expect everything to be very well taken care of. And that's part of the culture. And the Topeka team is to, in every way possible, go above and beyond to give the guest an experience that they can't get in the real world. So what I mean by can't get in the real world, at a normal concert. I'm going to one tonight in my hometown. It's going to be a great experience. I'm going to see a live band, and it's going to be more of a, what I would call a one to many experience. The band is on the stage. They're playing to many out into the arena. We try and create experiences that are more one-to-one, one-to-one fan-to-fan, one-to-one band-to-fan, and even one-to-one band-to-band, because in a multi-day experience, the bands are there for multiple days. They are forming connections with other bands. They're collaborating. They're joining each other on stage. They're writing songs in the back. And when they're doing things like that, when a guest gets to see two artists on the lineup collaborate on the same stage, you just don't tend to get that when you go see one band in any given time. As far as the comforts to lean into the vacation part, Topeka has been innovative, ironically, came out of COVID. When Andy formed Topeka, it was in the height of COVID, and he was one of the first festivals that did an open-air outdoor festival in the States, and he had to separate people by 6 feet. So we formed these coves, and coves are essentially wood posts with nautical rope with 2, 4, or 6 chairs, and everybody gets their own space for the entire 3-day weekend. We couldn't have people in lines, so they configured an innovation where from an app, you can order all of your food, drink, and merchandise from your phone, from your cove, and it's delivered to your cove in 5 minutes or less. So when COVID subsided, the guest said, don't take away the coves. We love having our own space. Don't take away the delivery because I can be with my people. I can talk to the people. I can enjoy the music. I don't have to walk away and disrupt the experience. So I think what people are finding that they really love about what we're putting forth for them is we're trying to take all the friction out of the live outdoor music experience. We bundle in accommodations along with a 3-day music pass. So you get to the beach, you have a condominium, you can walk right to the venue, you go into your own cove, you order your food, drink, and merch to your cove, and there's air-conditioned bathrooms. It's just a very comfortable, immersive experience. We have activities with artists. We brand the venue so that you really feel like you're in the world of the certain artists that you're there on vacation with. We find moments at the beach and with activities to ensure the fans and bands can connect, but the fans and fans can connect as well. And what we're being told is that we're bringing people back to live music because, you know, sometimes you do age out of going to a large open air 100,000 person festival. Ours can hold 5,500, which is still very intimate. These innovations have separated us that we just haven't seen anything like it in the States. And there's some really great things going on with Mexico with all-inclusive resorts for artists. Six Man's a Leader doing festivals at sea, and they're doing fantastic. But there was a void in the market to provide these kind of comforts that can set the stage for community. So I think that's what we're seeing.
Fantastic. I was just, you know, envisioning that scenario where drinks keep appearing and merch appears and you don't have to queue for like hours and it's tick, tick, tick. This is fantastic. I can imagine once people go on a Topeka music vacation experience that their expectations are set very high for everything else. That is kudos for that, man. That sounds absolutely amazing. And let's talk about this kind of overlapping Venn diagram of music and tourism. Leonika, you gave us that great definition of music tourism, and it's about a lot of stuff all under this umbrella. But let's look at that part that's the overlap of the Venn diagram of music and tourism. How does this deliver value in ways that music and tourism separately cannot deliver? What magic happens in that overlap?
First of all, I think tourism has had a bad rap in terms of over-tourism, but also in terms of touristifying culture, for example. What music tourism can do, yes, on the one hand, it can stifle local traditions because it's performed for tourists. On the other hand, what it can also do is actually we see in some cases that it helps to preserve local culture and local music styles and genres. So in that sense, it can be beneficial actually for local communities. It also relates to something that Anthony spoke about, and that's he is more in the luxury segment of music tourism. And actually what you see happening now as a countermeasure to over-tourism, what happens is that tourism agencies try to attract new audiences and audiences that stay longer. And this is when you speak about, for example, city trips, that you don't want people coming in. For example, I'm in the Netherlands. Amsterdam has a lot of people coming in for stag parties and whatever that local communities are not necessarily happy about. So when you focus on more of a niche tourism like music tourism, you attract a different audience. You attract a different tourist that usually stays a bit longer, spends a bit more money at your destination. which is one of the things that you could do to try to counter negative effects of impacts of tourism. So in that sense, the combination of music and tourism, again, can be very helpful and beneficial for fans or for travelers. The combination adds a meaningful layer to the trip, to the experience. And that's actually what my first book was about, on musical topophilia. It's very much exploring music tourism from this personal perspective. And there you see that music, as we, and probably listeners also can relate to, is very personal. Music is there in important moments throughout your life. And when, what I see with people going really, especially on these pilgrimages, is that that's the kind of music that they visit in real life, and they revisit, in a sense, their own journey through life. So it's really a journey towards yourself, as well as a journey as a tourist.
Oh, well said. Yeah, that's absolutely beautiful. As you were talking there, I was thinking very much of the incredible music week that they have in Tallinn, Estonia, and that is just exceptional. It is kind of a bastion of cultural progressiveness and cutting edge tastemaker curation from the entire world, but with a real focus on the East, on the Baltics, and you will absolutely see acts there that are difficult to see anywhere else. And they put it together so beautifully in this medieval gem of a city. So that's one of my favorite overlaps right there. But Anthony, what would be your take on this beautiful overlap between music and tourism in terms of the value for the fans and for the artists? What can they get out of music tourism that they can't get separately from music and tourism?
I think from the artist's perspective, more and more, they're finding out with the change of the economics of the business, with streaming and not maybe yielding the same revenues that vinyl or cassettes or CDs did over the years, that they have to tour, and they have to tour a lot to get to the revenues that they expect and that they deserve. I think with the festival market, you know, high profile artists can build up other people's festivals, but more and more you're seeing them curate their own festivals. And that's really the world Topeka sits in. We help artists curate their own festivals. So last weekend, we just did Luke Combs' Bootleggers Bonfire. Luke Combs is doing stadiums throughout the globe. He's one of the most iconic country music artists on the globe. And he created a 3-night weekend just for members of his fan club, the Bootleggers. And that's something where he can own his own festival, curate the lineup, curate the programming. Everything about it fits into his world. Custom merchandise, custom brands. So I think for the artist, they're realizing, one, they can find ways to tour that are more comfortable. You know, when we do a Bootleggers Bonfire, we put Luke, his wife, and his family and kids in a beautiful beach house. They're very well served. You know, it's different than being backstage all day and going from bus to bus to bus or town to town to town. So they create their own franchises. They own their own franchises. It's a very comfortable environment for their friends and family. And then they get to spend time with other artists over 3-4 days that they don't tend to get time to do, as I mentioned, you know, when they're normally just coming on and off a festival stage. So for the fans, they get everything that the doctor was mentioning. They get a pilgrimage to a new exciting town. By day, they're enjoying the beach. They fully enjoy the beach too. So we call it a music vacation because it's kind of flip. It's vacation by day and music by night. So it's not uncommon for our guests, and I say guests because we take it that seriously, where we're welcoming them into our home, you know, this venue, these 3 days and this experience we create for them. But they're going parasailing and they're going fishing and they're laying out in the sun, but they're doing it with others that they haven't met and realize that they're their best friends because they both love everything about Luke Combs or Brandi Carlile or the other artists that we get to serve. So the fans get a really compelling vacation because if you think about, even if you go to an exciting city, your entertainment at night might not be exactly what you love. Like you might be just looking through things to do and say, okay, let's do this. This looks interesting. But if you love Luke Combs and you get to see him play a 2-hour set of deep cuts that he would never play on tour, that's incredibly unique and exciting. So to go back to, for the fans, we try and create experiences that you can't get in the real world. We had something called Lukeyoki last weekend where fans got to sing Luke Combs songs with Luke Combs band as the backup band live on the main stage, right? The guests love it. The people watching it love it because they're rooting for their fellow Luke fans. And we just constantly try and do things like that. We did a drum circle on the beach with Luke's drummer. The guitar player loves cigars. So there was a porch hang where you can smoke cigars with the guitar player. So It's a massive value to the artist, to the fan, and then everything we've talked about to the local community. The people renting these condos are very much welcoming us into the market because April, May, and October, November, those condos aren't being rented. Now they're being rented at a, you know, fair price, and it works out great for everybody. So
win-win. I love it. The middle of that Venn diagram is just win. Brilliant. That's very cool. Thank you. And Leonika, coming back to yourself now, you've written and explored this idea of the halo effect that music can have on a city or a place. And indeed, I went to Detroit recently. That was somewhere I'd always wanted to visit. So I'm a big kind of Detroit soul fan. I made a little pilgrimage to the Motown Museum. I bought the t-shirt. I visited some techno places. You've written in detail about Detroit specifically. What did this teach you about the bonds between a place or a city and its musical history?
I'm glad you like Detroit so much. I've actually lived there for 3 years, the better part of 3 years, and it's really stolen my heart as well. It's such a fascinating city. Just its urban development and unfortunately decline, but also now regeneration. And for me especially, I was interested in the role of music in all of that. And for me, what was really interesting is it has such a rich musical history. It's Motown, but also the birthplace of techno. Madonna grew up close to it. Aaliyah, for some people still remember her, she was from Detroit. And what's interesting to me is, despite that rich musical heritage, it's not one of the megastar music cities that we know today, like Liverpool, like Nashville, like Memphis. So why was that the case? And that's what I explored when I lived in Detroit. There's a lot of things going on in Detroit, but what you do see there is that the value of that cultural heritage for the identity of the city and the local pride that people still have in Detroit, it's immeasurable. But of course, it's also a story of investment, private investment. It's a story of opportunity as well. You need to have companies like Anthony's that invest and that really develop music tourism as an industry as well. And there you do see some things happening in Detroit, but because of its difficult history, it's hard to sustain it. So it will be interesting to see in the upcoming years what will happen. The Motown Museum has announced a huge expansion and is building that. But also around techno, there were plans to create a nightclub like Tresor in Berlin, actually with Dimitri Hegemann. But I think actually the project developer dropped out of the ideas, and also it was hard to connect it to the actual techno scene there. So it's a complex narrative with a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of pride on that heritage and history, but they're not at Memphis or Nashville status yet. Although what you do see, taking that more helicopter view, is that music is able to play a role for what we call post-industrial cities of decline. So cities that have seen like the major factory and industry leave, and what comes in its place, what happens in those urban cores when all that industry leaves and what replaces it. And over the years, we've seen a lot of enthusiasm for art and culture, and music very much can be part of it. And actually, someone who's very invested in it has been a guest on your show already, Shane Shapiro, working on music cities. And that still is a theme to be considered.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, I'm glad you picked up on that chat with Shane. He is such a leader in his work with sound diplomacy in this field. I loved the chat that we had because he was talking about the kind of extra value that a music city has. So it's not just even about the bands, the fans. It's about the person getting a weekend job in the coat check at the venue. It's folks who are getting their first job behind the bar, and this gives them social skills. It's the folks who have a garage band and they kind of use it to cut their teeth in terms of negotiating and networking. And the whole music economy infuses so many soft skills and very valuable business skills into a city that it's kind of an incubator in a way that most cities don't look at it. I mean, I loved, by the way, I should give a quick shout to the good people at Harman and Harman Automotive, who have a very significant presence out in Novi next to Detroit, and they are all music lovers from the Motor City, so it was great to visit them as well. But this thing that Shane was talking about, the additional layer of value that comes from just having culture, just having music in a city, what's your kind of take on a place that is getting this right? I mean, is there anywhere that you'd like to name check? You kind of mentioned Nashville and Memphis there. Have either of you seen a place that's really just crushing it?
I think actually you've already mentioned the value of airwaves for Reykjavik. they are doing it right. Also because it indeed extends the tourism season, but it's also very much part of the city and carried by locals. And I think that's very important, that sense of community, because the criticism on kind of using art and culture and music, for example, as a way to redevelop a city, is that it's not a one size fits all. So there's not one formula for a city to become successful through music tourism. So even though a consultancy might try to sell you the idea that, oh, if you do this and this and this, you become a successful music city, that's not the case yet. We don't know. But every city is unique, has its own history. In economic geography, we call that path dependency, to throw in an academic term. But it means that you cannot just say, okay, we need more venues and this, and we'll invest in our live music sector and then we'll be successful. No, each city has its own story, like Detroit, which influences how this development works. So that's, I think, very important. And also with all the positive things around music tourism, also there's a tension between people coming to visit and kind of the industry and the investment there and the local people who are maybe sometimes also not that happy about music tourism, because venues also cause noise. There's a hot topic now about noise complaint. And if a neighborhood develops, people come in to live there and then they start to complain about the nice club that actually enticed them to the neighborhood. But when you live above it or close to it, it's suddenly not as nice anymore. So we also see these issues. And even with very successful examples, we do see these issues coming up. Also, there's the example of Austin, Texas, for example, where they invested in music tourism. But I've also seen a critical piece on this saying, yeah, but whose music and whose heritage are we celebrating? And I think that is one of kind of the hot topics for the future of music cities, for example, and music tourism, is who does this benefit? Who is heard? To what extent does it involve the community? So, yeah, it's a nuanced image there.
Fascinating, Leonika. My goodness, I'm going to be keeping my eyes on your future publications, because every time you answer a question, it opens up a lot of topics and a lot of really fascinating avenues. And a big shout to the good people at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. It is where I had my country music epiphany, watching Jimmy Dale Gilmore play a gig in Lucy's Fried Chicken restaurant. It was absolutely emotionally devastating. It was incredible. I wasn't expecting it. So that's very much, you know, homegrown talent right there. Coming over to yourself, Anthony, what's a place that exemplifies a good balance between music and tourism and identity? Is there anywhere that you've been that you've just thought, wow, this place is really getting it right?
I think you can create it in places other than just the norm or the obvious. We never thought a cruise ship would be an interesting place to do a music festival. And I don't think anybody really thought Miramar Beach, Florida was going to be an interesting destination. And we are now looking at some West Coast locales that we can expand in the next 24 months. And they're not necessarily the names of the places you would expect, but if you have a compelling air flight, you have infrastructure for us, condominiums and a green space for the event, and a local workforce like you're talking about that can help support the event that you can add value to, you know, promoters like us are willing to bring the experience, to bring the infrastructure, to bring the artists, and the fans will come. I think 75% of our fans are flying or driving in. We're not really pulling as much from the local community. So I've been inspired, having done festivals on remote islands when I was with Norwegian and Six Man, and I've done big festivals with John Prine in the DR, and there's people doing really interesting things in Mexico. Like, there's lots of different ways to look at this differently, I think. And I think that can really benefit some of the cities that aren't Nashville and New York and LA, and right, these big mega cities that are already doing pretty well. So I guess that's where I would be inspired is where can you bring in and build it so that you can add value to somebody who maybe wasn't on that top 10 list.
There's some good food for thought there. If any of our listeners are involved in that kind of sector and would like to see something happen, I guess, should they reach out to you on LinkedIn or somewhere, Anthony?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a part of our roadmap for expansion. And we know we'll be bringing tremendous amount of value into the communities, economic impact. And then we would just be looking for some support. That support just might be infrastructure or staffing. Tourism boards are reaching out to us, because what ends up happening, if you pick a city like Miramar Beach, Florida, for example, when you have Luke Combs promoting it and Tedeschi Trucks and the Avett Brothers and Brandi Carlile, there's a tremendous amount of marketing going from an artist to their fans who really believe in listening and acting on what the artists are saying, right? Luke is inviting his fans to Miramar Beach, Florida. That is amazing marketing for Miramar Beach, Florida, when Topeka is and isn't operating. So tourism support would be something that we're looking into. And it's not just us. There's, you know, some great organizations. I'm friends with the guys at Danny Wimmer Presents. They do big rock festivals in the United States. And they're doing a lot of value in cities like Jacksonville and in Kentucky, Sacramento. These aren't like the A markets you think of, but they're bringing thousands and thousands of music fans in with very high profile events and adding a lot to the community. So I think the trick in all this is, though, being, I hate the word promoter, but essentially I'm a promoter, is a tremendous amount of risk in this game. And that's why we do need to partner with the local entities to, you know, to bring down some of that risk. A promoter can do really well in three nights and they can do really bad in three nights. And, you know, the food trucks are going to get paid and the band's going to get paid and the branding company is going to get paid. But at the end, the promoter's left with what they're left with. But when it all works, it does work well. You know, we do a lot of planning and research and analysis to decide what fan base has the passion to go on a music vacation. You know, there's a lot of artists that their fans are into them enough to spend $70 to go see a concert in their hometown. It's a whole different level of passion to want to go on vacation with an artist, to want to spend the premium, your vacation days and dollars. And trying to analyze that passion over the years, it's tricky. We're using some tools and instruments to try and get a better grasp of, why does this artist use fish? You know, right? People will travel all over the world for fish. Well, maybe that's not the case with another artist that might be coming to us and saying, will you curate a weekend for me? It's really important to do the homework and the data analysis to understand the fan bases as much as you can, because we're placing a big bet.
Absolutely. So it's all about the partnerships there. So folks, if you're listening, if you can partner with the good people at Topeka, you know where to find Anthony Diaz. It's on LinkedIn and in real life, of course, one of those great events. But Leonika, coming back to yourself, in your fabulous book, Music and Tourism, you imagine the city of the future. Could you take our listeners there for a little while?
Indeed. So from moving from that very personal perspective I had before, I'm indeed now looking more at the role of music in urban and regional development. And what interests me there is what I already spoke about, is who is represented by music, whose voice gets a place when music is commemorated and gets the stage the way it does in certain music cities, when it becomes interesting for commemoration and for tourism. So as I said, I don't believe there's a one size fits all. And I think for the future, it's really about looking at what way are cities developing and regions developing, what makes them sustainable, because that's, of course, now the big challenge. And in what ways? Is sustainability only ecological? Is it the green city? Or is it also social and cultural? What sustains communities in a way? And I think for music, there's a lot to say there. And actually, we started this podcast talking about that, the power that music has to create community, to sustain community. So this is where interesting questions lie, I think. Actually seeing music as a commons, for example. For me, that's the future. For looking into music and tourism and cities and urban and regional development.
Oh my goodness. It's like we're all on a journey. We're moving towards this, you know, increased connection with each other because of our love for music and our need to have these sustainable experiences and places together. Fascinating. Anthony, we've just heard the glimpse into the future from Leonika. What is the future of music tourism from your perspective over at Topeka?
I was exposed to, I'm not sure if you've read anything by Rob Abelow. He's got a work called Where Music Is Going. And I really think he's doing some interesting work. And I made note of it. He was saying the macro trends in music were from followers to fans, from passive to interactive, from audience to community, from superstars to niche stars, from vanity metrics to fandom metrics, rented audience to own audience. And then instead of using a platform, the artist is the platform. And I really subscribe to everything he's saying. This shift towards truly valuing and connecting and serving your core fans, to me, if I was an artist, I would be leaning heavily into that. And I think Topeka is just very well positioned for that trend, because we can super serve their core fans. We can make them fans for life. You know, when somebody comes to a Topeka event, we'll talk to the artist a few months later, and they're going to see the bands they discover in their hometowns. And they're holding up signs saying, I was just on vacation with you. they're the ones that are buying the VIP packages and buying the merch and social sharing. Like, they become very ardent ambassadors of the artist because they shared a moment in life with them that becomes an annual moment in life with them that is really important. So for us, it's to do more and more focus on interactive community-based programming, not just a concert, and then seeing how we can expand that to other markets in the States and probably abroad down the line as well. I mean, we're placing the bet that if we can attract people who work with Topeka that care at a level that you just can't teach or train, right? We're just so blessed to have a team that goes above and beyond. You have to do that in experiences like this. You have to anticipate guest needs. And the Topeka team does an amazing job of that. So if that happens, if guests continue to prioritize experiences over material things and place in music, like what we've been talking about, and artists prioritize having a real relationship with their core fans, you know, I think our future is bright and I'm really excited about it.
Phenomenal. My goodness, watch this space. That's two very exciting perspectives from the future from each of you there. I have two final questions, kind of quick fire questions. Do you have a favorite music tourism experience so far? If so, what is it and why did you choose it? And I'll come to yourself first, Leonika.
So I was a bit in doubt about which one to mention because I've been on a lot of music tourism experiences. But for me still, it's the Motown Museum in Detroit. I really enjoyed the tour there. You're taken around the museum before its expansion and you end up in Studio A singing Motown songs, and also knowing that sometimes Martha Reeves of Martha and the Vandellas actually joins tour groups. It's like, oh, will she be there? I mean, it's a wonderful experience. I can recommend it to everyone going to Detroit. Book that tour. We'll see what it becomes when the museum actually expands. But
oh, hell yeah. I did that tour earlier this year myself, and I can strongly agree with everything that you've said there, Leonika. It's a wonderful visit, particularly for a Motown and soul nut like myself. Anthony, come on over to yourself. What is your favorite music tourism experience so far?
So ironically, you know, like the cobbler has no shoes. I've been taking people on music vacations for the last 13 years and I haven't been on many myself. But ironically, mine happened 2 weeks ago. I was raised with a father who absolutely loved the Eagles. And he got me and my brother really deep into the Eagles. And I got my children deep into the Eagles. So 2 weeks ago, we all went to Vegas and we got to see the Eagles in the Sphere. And what's really interesting, when I got home and when my wife asked me about it, there's no doubt it was great seeing the Eagles. And there's no doubt that the Sphere is a marvel. But it was being together at breakfast. It was being together by the pool. It was looking forward and talking about what songs are they going to play tonight? What are they going to open with? I got to bond with my father and my sons in a manner where the music and the Eagles were the backdrop to my vacation, the soundtrack to my vacation. It was certainly why we were there. I never would have been on vacation and never have been on vacation with my father and my sons. And the Eagles made that happen. It's a memory that there's no doubt I will cherish for a lifetime. And that's what I mean by it's not about the Sphere. It's not about the Cove. It's not about the venue. Wembley's great. It's about the mortar in between the brick that happens on experiences like these.
Beautiful, man. I got goosebumps as you were talking about that experience. That's so cool. And I'm so glad you had that. That's beautiful. And I have one more music-related question for each of you. And it is a question that we ask all of our VIP guests on the Audio Talks podcast. And that is to choose a track for our VIP title playlist. So, Leonika, what say you?
Actually, I'm going with the other music tourism experience I was in doubt about. So the track I choose is called Little Heart from Michael Kiwanuka. And it's the soundtrack song to Big Little Lies. And actually, when I lived in the US, I visited Carmel by the Sea from the series. It always immediately brings me back to that moment, but also somehow has come to represent my time in the US. And I think this is so powerful about music tourism, that a song, music, can open up this whole imaginative world when you listen to it and transport you to whatever place it represents for you. So for me, that would be the track.
Gorgeous choice there. Thank you very much. And Anthony, how about yourself? What track are you going to add to the playlist?
I've been really inspired by, there was a period of music for my kids where there was no musicians, meaning no people playing instruments, right? It got very digitized. And I was really, really excited to see both of my sons turn me on to a band called The Sacred Souls. very soulful, very smooth, retro, kind of Motown-esque, but still modern with a great, great funky vibe. And they discovered it on NPR Tiny Desk concerts. I'm not sure if you're familiar with those, but they're really cool. It's not just the band or the vibe of the song. It's the fact that my kids are watching NPR Tiny Desk concerts. That's really good. And that it's bands that are stripped down, playing their instruments. There's no auto-tune and there's no layers and layers of, you know, overdubs. It's just clean, pure music. And I'm really enjoying it. And Can I Call You Rose is one of their cooler songs, if you want to throw that on the track.
Fantastic. My goodness, I have to confess, I'm not familiar with that band, but I would be absolutely diving into that track and their back catalogue. They sound brilliant. And my own contribution to this episode's playlist, with a little nod of the cap to the studio that Leonika and myself both visited in Detroit. It's the Motown sound, directly from the Motor City. Junior Walker and the All-Stars with Roadrunner. It's like an anthem to the love of travel itself. So I thought that might be appropriate. So listen, thank you so much for joining us on the Audio Talks podcast. That was so fascinating. I'm packing my bags, bringing my toothbrush, and cannot wait for our next music tourism journey. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Leonika Bodeman.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Brilliant. And thank you for joining us, Anthony Diaz.
Thank you for having us. It was a pleasure speaking with both of you.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe, comment, and share Audio Talks with your friends and family. If you are enjoying the Audio Talks series of podcasts, why not pop over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave a nice review. It really does mean a lot, and it helps new listeners to get to know the well-traveled global guests we talk to in every episode, like Dr. Leonika Bodeman and Anthony Diaz. For more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. We'll be back soon for some more globe-trotting Audio Talks. See you next time.